This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It has been a long, cold winter, and the sounds of spring, however, are now upon us.
And this is the sound of one of the most common birds in North America, the Melospiza melodia, better known as the song sparrow.
They live in bushes and trees, picking around your front lawn maybe, and you've probably heard its lovely song, perhaps even seen one.
But how would you recognize it? They're rather stalky with a long tail. They have bold, coarse streaks about and below, converging in a large spot on the center for the breast. They have a grayish face and rufous-tinged wings and tail.
That's the description of the song sparrow found in one of the Bibles of the birding world, the Sibley Guide to Birds, which is out now in its long-awaited, beautifully illustrated second edition. And if birding is a sport, or perhaps an art, David Allen Sibley is its revered documentarian. The first edition of the Sibley Guide sold more than 1.7 million copies, and his very name has been turned into a noun in the field, as in, is that a rhinoceros auklet? I don't know. Did you bring your Sibley? Well, we have our Sibley right here in the flesh. David Allen Sibley lives in Concord, but he joins us in the studio today. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the show. And forgive me, but I'm hoping that I can just start by putting you on the spot a little bit, because I want to play another bird sound, which I'm guessing you're going to probably recognize, okay? So let's play this to begin with. You want to take a guess? I'm hoping we have the right one, because we picked a very particular one,
that
and I'm not the expert.
I'm going to guess a magnolia warbler.
Nailed it! Absolutely. It is the magnolia warbler, which listeners might have seen here in New England, although it winters in the Caribbean. But it's also the illustration that's on the cover of the second edition of the Sibley Guide. And it's an important bird in terms of your personal story regarding birding. So can you tell us a little bit about the warbler and why you fell in love with it?
Yeah, well, I started birding as a young kid, and my father's an ornithologist. I'm sure that had something to do with my early interest in birds. But when I was in third grade, he was working at Point Reyes Bird Observatory in California. And I came home from school one day, and he was at home with some other people from the bird observatory. And that was unusual for him to be home in the middle of the afternoon. And they had brought to the house this rare bird that had been trapped at the bird observatory, where the birds are trapped and banded. They're mm-hmm. they're marked with a numbered tag on their leg and then released. But this one they brought to the house because it was a spring-plumaged male magnolia warbler, the first one that had ever been trapped and banded there, and one of very few records in the state of California at that time.
Oh, wow.
And I was only in third grade, but I had been birding for a year and knew the picture from the book, and I knew that it was incredibly rare, and just to see it right there in our house, to hold it in my hand, was just an incredible experience.
I mean, was it like a, I mean, I can, they're small, right? So I can imagine there was this trembling little creature in your hands when you were, what, nine?
Yeah.
Eight
years old. Yeah, they're very small, like 8 grams, a third of an ounce. Huh. Just incredibly full of life. If you, you know, I'm sure some of the people listening have had a chance to hold a bird. One of the things you notice is how light they are, but how full of energy.
Yeah.
And this one was, on top of all that, just like a little feathered jewel of yellow and black and gray and white. And then we let it go. It flew off into the woods, and it, of course, disappeared. Nobody ever saw it again, which is the way birds go. But it's sort of, you're left with this feeling of, what else is out there? What's going to be in the next bush? What's going to show up tomorrow?
Is that what you really love about birding? That it's, I mean, it's something, it's very transient. It's very in the moment. The birds are there when they want to be, and then they're gone.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge part of it. And especially right now, this time of year, the birds are migrating. There's this huge global movement of birds, billions of birds moving north right now. And you could wake up in Massachusetts, and if you're listening or watching the birds in your yard, tomorrow morning there could be 10 species that weren't there today. They just appear overnight.
Wow.
And that's that, and it's just that there's no way, no matter how good you get at identifying birds, you still have no control over where the birds are going. You just go out and see what's there, and you never know what you're going to find.
Well, listeners, I'm speaking with David Allen Sibley. The second edition of the Sibley Guide to Birds is now out. It's got hundreds of new illustrations on it. We're going to talk about the art in the guide in a second, including some ultra-rare species in North America. So I'm guessing that a lot of listeners out there have at least the first edition. And if you've got a question for David Allen Sibley, if you're a birder and you love those magical moments when the birds appear and then they disappear, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm curious if you take your Sibley with you out into the field and what it is you love about birding in particular. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also, I'm about to say this, send us a tweet at Radio Boston. It may be the most appropriate use of the term ever. But anyway, so David, tell us, you told us about the Magnolia Warbler, one of your spark birds, so to speak. But I'm wondering about why and how you ended up being an illustrator and such a close observer of birds that the first edition of the Sibley Guide came into being.
Yeah, well, I started with an interest in birds very young, but also an interest in drawing. And for me, the two things have always gone together. And the drawing is it's always been scientific illustration. It's about information. And it's a way of studying birds, a way of learning about them, so that I use the drawing as a way to work through all of the aspects of what a bird looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I learn by drawing and by studying the birds in order to draw them. So that it all goes together for me. Bird watching and drawing are parts of the same thing, and it just the more I learned, the more I wanted to put it all together into a compilation like a book.
Yeah. And I have a couple questions about the mechanics of how you do your illustrations, because, you know, I imagine you sitting out in the field with your telescope and your binoculars. You kind of have to wait for your subjects to appear when they want to. And even though individual species absolutely have characteristic shape and coloring, etc., there have to be the variations within the actual individual birds that you're looking at in the same species. So how do you decide sort of how to actually put it all together into what's going to be your final illustration?
Yeah, that's one of the big challenges, is trying to pick the average, the sort of typical individual of each species or each plumage. So I spend a tremendous amount of time in the field just watching, and watching birds, looking at shapes and posture, and trying to, I might spend 20 minutes drawing, 20 minutes watching for every minute that I spend actually putting pencil on paper.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of looking and watching and sort of summarizing in my mind or trying to learn what the average shape is and then finally putting that on paper.
Why do you think, for the purposes of a birding guide, that illustrations, or do you think illustrations, are superior to photographs?
I do think they're...
I mean, asking a master illustrator, I understand, but I'm curious why you think that.
Yeah, after all the years of painting, it would be hard for me to answer any differently. But I think that the advantages that illustrations have over photographs are, first, that it allows me as the illustrator to be in complete control of what I show. The posture, the plumage, the shape, the lighting, all those things are under my control. So I can make the illustrations comparable in a way that only an illustration can be, and show the sort of average individual.
Right.
But it also, it allows me to simplify the images, to take out a lot of the details, and to strip away all the background. And I think that one thing that helps to do is it removes any suggestion of a story or an experience from the field guide, so that no matter what you've seen in the field, whether you've seen the bird in snow or fog or bright sun, in a forest or in a field or on a beach, it will still match the illustration in the field guide.
Right. A cardinal is a cardinal is a cardinal, regardless of if it's snow or springtime.
Yeah. And a photograph tells you a story of a moment in time that might not match what you've just seen yourself.
Now, there are thousands of birds in the guide here, 600 new paintings, and 111 rare species have been added. Have you seen, I know you haven't seen absolutely all of them that are in the guide, but you've seen most of them?
Most of them, yes. I haven't counted. In the first edition, there were 8 species that I had never seen, and in the 14 years since then, I've seen 5 of those 8. Now, I added a bunch of new rare species to the second edition, so I haven't counted, but I'm guessing it's now 15 or 20 species in the book that I've never seen.
Okay, well, we've actually got some tape of one of those, which I think you still haven't seen yet. And the tape, I should say, comes from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, where you once worked many moons ago. Fantastic resource for anyone who loves animals, and especially birds. They've got phenomenal recordings there that are all available online. Let's listen to the call of this particular bird. So a fantastic sound. That's the Gunnison sage grouse?
It is, yeah.
And you've never seen it?
I actually saw it for the first time just a month and a half ago
Colorado,
yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's a rare one.
It's rare. It's only found in a small area in southwestern Colorado in the Gunnison Valley, and there are only about 4,000 of them in total.
In North America or in the world?
In the world. That's the only place they're found. And the world, the total population is under 5,000.
So that must have been quite a thrill.
It was, yeah. It was great. And that's just the way they sound. But to hear that, you have to get out. You have to get up at 3:30 in the morning, drive out to the area where the males are going to display, and get yourself into position and wait for sunrise. And then they start to show up before first light. The males will come out onto this display ground and gather, and they start making that sound while it's just barely light enough to see them.
Wow.
And it gradually gets lighter and more birds show up, and it's just in the mountains it's the sagebrush in between the mountain ranges in southwestern Colorado, the sagebrush plains, and it's just a really fantastic place.
Well, David, we've got a lot of birders on the line who want to talk to you. Listeners, I'm speaking with David Allen Sibley. He is one of the legends in the world of birding. He lives in Concord. He's with us now talking about the new second edition of the Sibley Guide to Birds. So let's start hearing from our callers. Lee is calling from Reading. You're on the air, Lee.
Yeah, hi. My question is about the dawn chorus. I was raised in northern Westchester County over 40 years ago as a kid. I remember the tremendous racket of birds bursting to song at the crack of dawn. Mm-hmm. Now I'm a mom in north of suburban Boston, and I'm wondering, is there any place where I can bring my kids to hear something like that? At the crack of dawn, yeah, I hear birds, but nothing like I remembered, and I know the songbird populations have pretty much crashed. I know it's something like, 70-80% down, but I would just love my kids to be able to hear that, and I don't know where I could even find it if it's something that still exists, not too far away from where we live.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for your call, David.
Yeah, I think it happens this time of year. It happens at about 5 o'clock in the morning, like today. Between 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning, when it's just getting light, that's when the birds really, really tune up. And I think if you get out to a park with a good patch of woods, where there would be a lot of nesting birds, and it's species like rose-breasted grosbeak, scarlet tanager, red-eyed vireo, and the several species of warblers that nest in this area, those will be a big part of the dawn chorus. In your yard, you probably have robins and cardinals and chickadees and tufted titmouse, things like that. They'll also be a big part of any woodland area chorus. But if you can get to a park where there's, or a, a big patch of 100 acres or more of forest, you'll probably hear a pretty good dawn chorus.
Well, David, I want to play the sound or the song of another bird, because Lee had mentioned about the crash in the songbird populations worldwide, including North America. This is the call of the wood thrush, which has declined more than 40%, I believe, since the 1960s. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, is that part of why birding, you find birding so important? Because not only you're observing the birds, but you're learning about the environment that the birds are sort of representative of.
Yeah. It automatically makes connections. You find certain species in certain habitats that leads to an understanding of the importance of different habitats, the importance of diversity. What the birds are eating, what they build their nests out of, all those things are really key to their survival. And bird watchers are obviously going to be some of the first ones to notice if a species is declining in an area. They just get harder to find.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I keep looking at all these people who do want to talk to you on our call list, and I want to see if we can sneak a couple more of them in. Craig is calling from Florence. You're on the air, Craig.
Wow, I can't believe I feel like I'm talking to the god of birds. My God, this is like talking to Charles Darwin. I'm out in Florence, Mass., and I feed the birds out here. I'm also a sculler, so I get to see like the bald eagles, and there's a rookery for blue herons around here, which I won't name. But I'm wondering, I always try to feed these birds suet because I get a lot of beautiful woodpeckers. Even pileated come out here to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when do you stop feeding suet because it gets to be such a mess I think it gets rancid and stuff. I'm just wondering as a feeder when I should stop that.
As the general question of whether it's okay to feed birds year-round, it is. The birds don't get... it's not like you're offering them junk food or making them lazy or reliant on bird feeders. It's okay to feed them year-round. But suet is sort of a special case that it doesn't last very long in the hot weather of spring and summer. So I would say probably when the... if the outdoors is warmer than a refrigerator, it might be time to stop feeding suet. You could probably still put small bits out in the summer if they're going to be eaten up quickly, and the woodpeckers would enjoy that. But you don't want it to go to make a mess or get rancid.
We've got a tweet here from Ricky L. Jones, who sent us a message saying, "Mr. Sibley, are there still lifers, parentheses, birds, out there that you're still trying to find, or have you seen them all?"
There's still some, yes. And, well, in North America, in the world, of course, there are thousands that I've never seen. But, the Gunnison sage-grouse was the last North American breeding species that I hadn't seen. So the ones that are left are the species that are rare visitors to North America, like Aztec thrush that comes from Mexico. And just almost every year, some show up in Arizona just north of the border. Or Murphy's petrel, which nests in the South Pacific and shows up off California pretty regularly. But you have to be on a boat 100 miles offshore and get lucky.
Well, David Allen Sibley's new edition, the second edition of the Sibley Guide to Birds, is now out. And it is, you know, even if you never step foot outdoors, which I'm not recommending you do, it is luscious and beautiful to read. And, in the last, 5 seconds we have, I'm just curious, why are all the birds facing right in the book?
That is to make them easier to compare.
Okay.
So that they all match, and it's just easy to glance across the pages and see what the similarities and differences are.
Wow. Well, the illustrations are absolutely beautiful, and the information is wonderful. So thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And again, listeners, it's the Sibley Guide to Birds, second edition, now out. There's more information at radioboston.org. But stick with us, because coming up, we'll speak with Cokie Roberts on the mothers, daughters, and sisters and wives who played a pivotal role in the American Revolution. But we're going to close this segment with another bird call, a truly beautiful one, one of my favorites. It's the haunting wail of a pair of common loons as they're calling back and forth to figure out where each other is on the water. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.